All right. Well, good evening. Said not this morning. So we're. Yes. Okay. So we're continuing our series on the resurrection. And last week we looked at the Abrahamic covenant and how the resurrection fits in with that. Do you guys remember there was five promises that we went through last week that God promised to Abraham in that covenant? Do you guys remember which one of those promises has not yet come to fruition? It hasn't been fulfilled yet.
Land is an everlasting possession.
Yeah, so the promise of the land as an everlasting possession hasn't come to fulfillment yet, and obviously the reason why Abraham is in the dust. So the only way that that promise can come to realization is through resurrection. Well, and we also looked at Galatians chapter 3, and we looked at how Paul applies some of the language that comes right out of Genesis in with regard to that covenant. You know, God repeated to Abraham over and over again in that covenant, "To you and your seed I shall give this land as an everlasting possession." And who did Paul, when he commented on the grammar in Galatians 3, who did he apply that seed to from the Genesis account? Yeah, good job, Addison. Jesus Christ. So Christ is that seed that the land promise ultimately comes through. And Paul goes on in later in Galatians 3 to talk about that all those baptized into him through obedience to the gospel also become heirs of that same promise. And it's not only those, you know, under this new covenant dispensation that are baptized and obey the gospel, it's also all those Old Testament saints from you know, all throughout the Old Testament that will also share in that inheritance as well. Paul comments in Hebrews about that, and he says how Jesus was the mediator of the new covenant for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the Mosaic covenant, that those who, having been called, are the Old Testament saints, may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance as well. So we will all receive that inheritance when Christ returns and the kingdom begins. Now, I want to look at, we're kind of going through the five books of Moses, and so looking at this topic of resurrection. I'd like to look at Genesis chapter 22 is the next place I want to go to, and this chapter actually kind of reiterates some of the concepts of the Abrahamic covenant as well. Many of you are pretty familiar with this chapter. Abraham takes his son out to do some things that God commands him. We'll start in verse 1. It says, "Now it came..." Oh, in this chapter, it has many prophetic symbols of Christ. And I'll point out some of them if you guys don't see them already as we're going along here. But I'll point out some of this prophetic symbolism that is, it's really interesting how it applied to Christ as well. So it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. And another thing I'm going to comment on throughout this chapter is who the person is that's actually talking with Abraham and interacting with Abraham. Now it says God tested Abraham, but we'll see here a little later in the chapter who it is given a title as well, another name. And God said to him, "Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love." So there, the reference, your only son that Abraham is taking up, "whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son. And he split the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, so notice that symbolism as well, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and the lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you." So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, and notice he laid it on Isaac, his son. And obviously you guys can see the connection with Christ and the cross. And he took the fire in his hand and the knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, "My father." So I think this is interesting too, that Isaac is kind of in, he's a little bit distressed about this situation. Abraham's taking him up. He sees the knife, he sees the fire, but he doesn't see the sacrifice. So Isaac is distressed about this. And if you kind of connect it with, you know, prophetically speaking with Christ, you remember Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was very distressed and he cried out, "My father," as well. And he said, you know, "If it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will." So I think it's very interesting that Isaac has that same, you know, distress here. And Abraham says to his son, "Here I am, my son." Then Isaac says, "Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide for himself the lamb." And obviously you guys can see the connection there. "For a burnt offering." So the two of them went together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. Now, notice that up until this point, it keeps referring to God telling him this, right? Well, notice here as we get to verse 11 how it changes. So God had told him, "And Abraham built there an altar and placed the wood in order. And he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood." And it's interesting that the Greek version actually says he bound his hands and his feet on the altar. Now, verse 10, "Abraham stretched out his hand and he took the knife to slay his son. But the angel," or the messenger of the Lord, "called to him from heaven and said, 'Abraham, Abraham.' So Abraham said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son,'" now notice this, "'from me.'" Now who, God is the one that's been telling him all this stuff all along, right? He's the one that told him to go take Isaac up. But yet we find in verse 11 that it's this messenger of the Lord also. Now, it goes on, and Abraham lifts his eyes and he looks, and there behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be provided." Then the angel or messenger of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord." So now we have the Lord actually being used interchangeably with this messenger of the Lord. And the Lord there, we're going to actually discuss that proper name later, but it's, you know, what you've heard, Jehovah or Yahweh, and we'll discuss that in a little bit. "Because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son." Now notice, this is the angel of the Lord saying this. He says, "Blessing, I will bless you, and multiplying, I will multiply your descendants," or seed, "as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is by the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men. They arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. Now, so the terms of the Abrahamic covenant are actually repeated again by this messenger of the Lord. You know, he says, "Blessing, I will bless you, and multiplying, I will multiply you." And he repeats that in your seed all nations shall be blessed. Now, this portion here about your seed or descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies, we're going to kind of get into this towards the end of our discussion today, but it's thoroughly connected with the Davidic covenant and the point in time when the resurrection takes place and the inheritance is given out. So, but we'll look at that in the latter half of this discussion. So, why is this chapter so important to our topic on the resurrection? Primarily, it's because of what Paul comments about it in Hebrews chapter 11. So, if you guys want to go to over to Hebrews chapter 11, we'll take a look at that. Now, this is in, we'll start in verse 17. It says, "By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, 'In Isaac your seed shall be called,' concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense." So, what, as Paul comments on this, what we just read in Genesis, what motivated Abraham to act in obedience and faith? He mentions it right here. He says that it was the resurrection, that he knew, Abraham knew that God had made some promises to him, some covenantal promises in that in what he God had told him. So he knew that if Isaac wasn't brought back to life, those promises would be null and void, and basically God would be a liar. So he knew that God had to abide by his promises, and it was his hope in the resurrection that Isaac would be brought back to life that caused him to have the obedience that he did and fear God in the way that he did. You know, I mean, think about this for some of us, you know, with Duke, with Hudson and me with Blaine. I mean, put yourself in Abraham's shoes. He just got this son through Sarah, which she was barren and couldn't even have children. And it's a miracle that Isaac was even conceived in the first place, which was part of one of the promises in the covenant. And then the next thing you know, God is telling Abraham to go kill him up on a mountain. I mean, it takes some extreme faith to respond in the way that Abraham did. But nevertheless, Abraham still obeyed. And, you know, for us, Paul says in Romans chapter 4, he says that those who are going to be reckoned righteous before God are those who walk in the same steps as our father Abraham. So in order for us to have that same type of faith that Abraham did, we should also have that same hope in resurrection that Abraham had. If we're going to, you know, look, if we're going to expect to have obedience and fear God and respond in our faiths, we should also have that same expectation that Abraham had for the resurrection. Now, something the Greek, I'll comment real quick on verse 19, where it says, "concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead." Where it says "to raise him up," that's not really in the Greek. It literally says, "concluding that God was also able to raise the dead," plural. It's referring to the dead as a class of people. So Abraham was, he concluded that this person that has given these promises to me, this God, has the power to raise all the dead if he so chooses. And no doubt, Abraham, part of Abraham's obedience when God told him to go sacrifice Isaac was the promise of the everlasting inheritance, because Abraham knew that in order for the everlasting promise of the inheritance to come to pass, you need resurrection. You need people to stand again on that port, on that piece of land permanently. So resurrection and God giving permanent life is required for that. So, you know, Abraham knew that God has that, that he's the only one that has that ability to give life or take it if he so chooses. And this is actually, we'll go to Exodus chapter 3 next. Multiple times in the Old Testament, you know, God says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, the reason that, God says that is connected with the eternal land inheritance. Because remember last week we looked at how God reiterated that land promise to all three of those men. And that's the reason why God associates himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So turn to me to Exodus chapter 3. Now, this is the burning bush account. We'll start in verse 1. Now, Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And notice here, you're going to see the same things going on as we did in Genesis 22 with this messenger of the Lord character. In verse 2, and the messenger of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So now notice in verse 4 here it says, the Lord, or Yahweh, saw that he turned aside to look. God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. So again, who is saying this from the burning bush to Moses? This,
the messenger of Yahweh was in the bush, and the messenger of Yahweh is God.
Yeah. So
the messenger of Yahweh is the Word.
Yeah. And this person, the messenger of Yahweh, you know, our purpose of this isn't to go into, you know, the Trinity, or exactly this person and everything. But as most of you know, the Word that became flesh in John's opening chapter in his Gospel, the Logos, this term that he uses for Christ, is this person that's interacting with Abraham and giving him the covenant, that's interacting with Moses and telling him, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the reason why this term of, you know, that God's saying he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is so important to our study on the resurrection is because Jesus actually comments on this very same particular portion of Scripture in Luke chapter 20. So if you want to go over to Luke chapter 20 with me, we're going to look at it real quick. Now, remember last week I told you that the Jews of Jesus' time were very familiar with the topic or the concept of the resurrection, that resurrection was a necessity for God's promises to be fulfilled through the Abrahamic covenant. And so much so, I mentioned that Jesus had debates with some of the Jewish leadership about the resurrection. And this is actually one of those accounts where Jesus is kind of discussing some of the more particular aspects of the resurrection. Now this same account is also in Matthew chapter 22 and Mark 12, but we're going to read it out of Luke's account because Luke adds something that Jesus says that none of the other gospel writers record that's really important to understanding what Jesus is getting at by what he says here. So we're going to start in verse 27. Then some of the Sadducees, who deny there is a resurrection, came to him and asked him, saying, Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies, having a wife, and he dies without children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers, and the first took a wife and died without children. And the second took her as wife, and he died childless. Then the third took her, and in like manner the seven also. And they left no children and died. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, now notice here again, you have the definite article like we talked about in our first lesson. It's referring to a specific resurrection. In the resurrection, whose wife does she become? For all seven had her as a wife. So Jesus answered and said to them, "The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are counted worthy to attain to that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage." Now, Jesus here is, when he's saying those who are counted worthy to attain to that age, he's referring to the end of this age and the beginning of the age when the kingdom arrives to this earth at the second coming of Christ. Now, the Greek is interesting here because where it says, "and the resurrection from the dead," it literally says, "and the resurrection, the one out from among the dead," plural. In other words, Jesus is referring to a specific resurrection that those who are worthy to attain to. Now, if you remember in Acts 24, when Paul was giving his account, you know, his defense, and he said that he believes everything that's written in the law and the prophets, that there will be a resurrection of the just and the unjust. So what Jesus is referring to here is that resurrection that is of the just. So he goes on in verse 36 and he says, nor can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels, and they are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. But even Moses showed in the burning bush passage that the dead are raised when he called the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For he is not the God of the dead, but of the living. For all live to him. Then some of the scribes answered and said, "Teacher, you have spoken well." But after that, they dared not question him anymore. Now, this particular passage is often used by some who subscribe to the idea that we have a non-corporal ghost or spirit or something that leaves our body and goes to the celestial heavens after death. You know, they'll sometimes go to this verse and they'll say, "Hey, look, it says, you know, he is not the God of the dead, but of the living." So therefore, the conclusion then is that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are consciously alive right now, dwelling as ghosts or immaterial spirits in some location. But there's a big, big, huge problem with that. First of all, what is Jesus talking about here to the Jews here? He is making comments on what? The resurrection, right? So we must understand Jesus' words in the context of him giving a defense for why the resurrection is true and why it will happen. Now, there's also a very important aspect with the grammar here, where it says, "For he is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him." Now, "to him" is a pronoun, and it's in what we call the dative case. And a substantive that's in the dative case is often, typically it's the indirect object of the main verb. Now, it can have nuances such as, you know, position or the means by where something is done or reference to something or personal interest. Now, in this case, where you have this pronoun here, which is autos in the Greek, "to him," when it's modified by the verb "live" there, see where it says "all live to him"? Well, that verb in the Greek for "live" is a me, which is a verb of being. Well, when you have this construction with the verb of being, with the pronoun autos in the dative case, it's what Greek grammarians refer to as the ethical dative or the dative of feeling. I mean, in other words, it could be translated "as far as I'm concerned." So you could basically say, you know, "He is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for as far as God is concerned, all live to him." In other words, from God's unique perspective, are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob alive? And that's because Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are in the dust, but their breath, which God loaned to them while they were alive on this earth, returned to God, who gave it in the first place. And God is going to redistribute that breath at the resurrection. So from God's perspective, they are alive. You know, God does not, you know, he does not dwell, the Father does not dwell in this material creation. You know, Paul comments and says he dwells in unapproachable light. He's not restricted to time and such. So from God's perspective, you know, these men are alive. You know, an example would be in Philippians 1:21, Paul says, you know, to me to live as Christ and to die as gain. So, you know, from Paul's unique perspective, he's giving something that's, you know, revealing something to us. Now, here's the other thing, that why the idea that Jesus is teaching these Jews that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are floating around somewhere is nonsense, is because notice how some of the scribes answer. It says, then some of the scribes answered and said, "Teacher, you have spoken well." But after that, they dared not question him anymore. Now, the scribes were particularly associated with the sect of the Pharisees. You know, oftentimes in the New Testament, you find the scribes and the Pharisees being viewed as a unit together. In fact, in Acts chapter 23, verse 9, it says that the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested. So the scribes were part of the Pharisees' party, and the Pharisees staunchly held to resurrection. They did not believe in this Greek Platonic concept of an immaterial ghost or spirit that leaves the body and goes somewhere. They wouldn't have had that concept at all. Their hope would be in the resurrection, staunchly the hope in the resurrection. So for these scribes to say, "Jesus, you've spoken well," obviously they understood him to be talking about the resurrection. If Jesus was trying to give some proof text for the Greek idea of what happens after death, with the body being the cage for this soul, spirit, this ghost that is released upon death, they would never have said, "You've spoken well." They would have actually probably called him a heretic and said that you're teaching lies, you know. So now, does anyone have any questions about that? I know I went into some of the grammar. You know, I'll give you another practical example. Like, you know, some of you know Mike Cox, and I could say Mike Cox's beard to me is beautiful. Now, that might not be the case to some other people, but to me, from my unique perspective, it is. So,
well, again, the grammar is necessary and interesting, but you can get from the context of what you're reading right here.
Yeah.
That he's talking about resurrection. I mean,
yeah.
You can't insert some sort of mystical ghost thing.
Well, and the other thing, sometimes someone will say, "Look, it says he is the God of the living." And they'll say, "Look, it says they're living." Well, the living there is a participle that it's being used as a class of people, like just for the living as a class of people, okay? And again, they're living from God's unique perspective because he's going to raise them at the resurrection.
You know, it's kind of interesting where it says, "For all live to him." I wonder if they mean all. I mean, as far as everyone's going to be resurrected that ever lived.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in this context, because Jesus is talking about those who are counted worthy to attain to the resurrection, the resurrection, the one for, out from among the dead. He's referring specifically to believers here, because if you're the preposition that's used there implies coming out from among something else. So if there's a resurrection out from among the dead, it implies that there's dead still left that haven't been raised. And when we get in the New Testament, we'll look at particularly 1 Corinthians 15 that gives a sequence or order to the event of the resurrection. Now, The last passage that we're going to look at tonight is Deuteronomy chapter 32. So if you want to turn there, and it's connected with this whole concept of what we've been reading so far with God is the God of life. He distributes life as he will. He can take life. He's the one that has power over that. And Deuteronomy 32... this is the Song of Moses. And as most of you know, the book of Deuteronomy means second law. And it was Moses gave this whole, everything in this book, he gave a discourse to the children of Israel. as they were about to cross the River Jordan into the land of Canaan at the end of the 40 years of wandering through the wilderness. And Deuteronomy 32 is actually a song that was to be sung by Israel when they crossed over the Jordan into the land of Canaan. And God actually said that one of the reasons why he wants them to sing this song is so that, and through Moses, God prophesied that Israel would go into the land of Canaan, that they would forsake his covenant, and they would go after other gods and serve idols. And this song was to be a witness against the children of Israel that they had forsaken his covenant, and basically as a testimony that, see, you've been singing this as a song, and now you're doing it. You know, a way to convict them and provoke them to turn back to him and have no other gods before him. And we're not going to read the whole chapter, but we're going to go to the very end of the chapter in verse 39 and see what the end of this song has to say. So verse 39 says, "Now see that I am he, and there is no God besides me." Now, the Greek version, the Septuagint here, says, behold that I am. Now, and using this proper name, this I am name, now, where do you remember where God gave that name and who he gave that name to? Yeah, so back when we had just looked at Exodus chapter 3, when he said, "I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Yeah, he also went on and he was telling Moses, because Moses was like, you know, God told Moses to go tell Pharaoh to let his people go. And Moses says, okay, well, who exactly am I supposed to tell him sent me? You know, by what authority am I going to tell these guys? And God says, go ahead and tell them that I am sent you. In other words, go ahead and tell them that the self-existent one sent you. And this proper name in the Greek in the Old Testament, it's actually what we looked at in Luke 20, where I pointed out the verb for live means a me. It's a verb of being or existence. And that's the same verb that's used when God says, "I am that I am." In other words, I exist. I exist of my own self. There is nothing that I need that's external to me. In other words, and notice how he says when he opens this up in verse 39, he says, behold that I am. In the Greek version, he says there's no God besides me. In other words, I am the only being, or I am the only God that can say that can say I have inherent immortality of myself and I exist apart from nothing else. All other beings and so-called gods would then have to be created or would have to seek life from the one who gives life, because he's the only, you know, he's the one that, as Paul says in 1 Timothy 6:16, that God alone has immortality and no other being or part of creation possesses that immortality in and of themselves. So, and I mentioned that I was going to comment on the actual Hebrew name. So, I am is where we get the term Jehovah or Yahweh. In the Hebrew, it's the letters. It's Yod Hey Vod Hey, and it's called the unpronounceable name of God. And most translations render it Yahweh or Jehovah because no one really knows exactly what the exact name was that that God told Moses, but that's how it's rendered. So again, it just means this self-existent one, this one that exists in it, you know, of himself, and there's nothing that he needs apart from himself. And he opens that up, you know, reminding the children of Israel of what he told Moses back in Exodus chapter 3 about himself. And he says, "Now, behold that I am, and there is no God besides me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. nor is there any who can deliver from my hand. Now, these verbs for kill and make alive are future tense. It says, I will kill and to make I shall make alive. I will wound and I will heal, referring to a future aspect. You know, and again, nor is there any who can deliver from my hand, meaning I am the one that controls these things. And then he goes on in verse 40, he says, for I raise my hand to heaven and say, as I live forever, if I whet my glittering sword and my hand takes hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to my enemies and repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood and my sword shall devour flesh. From the blood of the slain and of the captives and from the heads of the leaders of the enemy. Now, this whole section about him taking vengeance on his enemies, you know, making his arrows drunk with blood and his sword devouring flesh, this is all referring to the second coming of Christ. In Revelation chapter 19... the imagery that is being drawn from this passage of Deuteronomy, John observes heaven opened, and he talks about, you know, I observe heaven and open, and behold, a white horse, and him who sat on it was faithful and true, and in righteousness or true justice he doth judge and make war. And he goes on and describes how he has these eyes like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no one knew except himself. And it says that he was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, which is basically what we're reading here from the book of Deuteronomy. Isaiah also comments, and actually John also draws this from Isaiah, and Isaiah 63 talks about the day of recompense of our God. You know, it's what the Old Testament prophets refer to as the day of the Lord. And Isaiah sees this imagery of this person. He says, who is this who comes from Edom and dyed garments from Bozrah? He sees someone coming out of Edom and Bozrah just drenched with something, and he has this conversation with this person and the conversations with God, and God says, you know, he says this person is traveling in great splendor and mightiness, and who are you? And God responds and says, it is I, the Lord, mighty to save. And Isaiah asks God in this vision, he says, why do you look as one who treads in the winepress, and is your apparel red? And then God responds to Isaiah, and he says, I have trodden the winepress alone, and from the people no one was with me, for I have trodden them in my anger and trampled them in my fury. Their blood is splattered upon all my garments, and I have stained all my robes. And then he says, for the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. And in the Greek version, the day of vengeance was in my heart, says the day of recompense was in my heart. And that's what John is referring to when he says that Jesus' robe is dipped in blood. And John goes on and he says that out of his mouth goes a sharp sword that with it he should strike the nations. And how Jesus is going to tread the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. So what is being spoken here in Deuteronomy 32 is that event of the second coming. You know, his sword shall devour flesh. You know, if he takes his flashing sword and his hand takes hold on judgment, this is what's going to happen to his enemies. Now, in verse 43, you can see this contrast with what happens with those who are his enemies and what happens to his servants. And what is interesting, what I want you to connect is, you know, here where it says, I shall kill, I mentioned it's future tense, and I will make alive. This is in reference to the I shall kill is his enemies, and the I shall make alive is his servants. So therefore, it must refer to resurrection, being made alive at the day of the Lord, when God brings a day of recompense, or when God settles the score, so to speak. And in verse 43, it says, now I'm actually going to read verse 43 from the Greek version. And here's why. Because there's a portion in this Greek version here that is completely not in our New King James Version Old Testaments, because it's not in the Hebrew. But where it does appear is in the book of Hebrews, and Paul actually quotes from this verse and includes a portion of this verse that's not here as we're reading this. So I want to read it out of the Greek version because that's what Paul was actually quoting in Hebrews. And we know if Paul quoted a portion of Scripture from the Greek Old Testament, that Scripture is inspired, and it must have originally been in there. So here's what it says. It says, "Be glad, O heavens, together with him, and give worship to him, all the messengers of God." And this part about all the messengers of God, or all the angels of God worshiping him, is what Paul quotes in Hebrews 1:6, where Paul says, speaking of the Father, he says, "When he again brings the firstborn into the land," and then he quotes here from Deuteronomy 32:43, "let all the angels of God worship him." And what that's referring to is when the Father again brings the firstborn, or Christ, into the land of the second coming, let all the angels of God worship him. In other words, as Jesus Christ in Daniel 7, as we mentioned last week, is presented with this kingdom from the Father, and he basically walks up and sits upon that throne of David in Jerusalem and reigns as king, all the angels are going to be worshiping him and bowing down to him as he takes his rightful seat that his Father promised him. Now, so that's the section that's left out here, because you don't see "let all the angels of God worship him" in our New King James versions here. And it goes on, and it says, then it says, "Be glad," and this is again from the Greek version, "Be glad, O Gentiles, with his people, and grow in strength in him, all you sons of God. For the blood of his sons he shall avenge, and he shall avenge and recompense punishment to the enemies, and to those despising him he will repay. And the Lord shall purge the land for his people." Now, why do you think it says... No, well, first of all, you see all the pronouns here where it says, "grow in strength in him, all you sons of God." "He shall avenge." "He shall make recompense and punishment to the enemies." "He will repay." All these pronouns, the antecedent to these pronouns, or what we refer to the person that it's referring to, that was actually mentioned earlier in Deuteronomy chapter 32, is the rock. This rock is mentioned. If you read the earlier portions of Deuteronomy 32, it mentions about this rock who carried the Israelites through the wilderness, and how they despised their rock that gave them all these blessings, and they turned from him. And in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul actually says that the rock that followed the children of Israel as they wandered through the wilderness was Jesus Christ. So when it's talking about he will avenge and he will repay his enemies, it's speaking of Jesus Christ. And so why do you think that the land needs to be purged in order for him to make his servants alive, as it says, "I kill and I make alive," through the resurrection? Well, that's actually kind of part of it, because the Hebrew, it says he will provide atonement for his land and his people. And the Greek version says he will purge out the land for his people. And basically what's happening is you guys are familiar with the Day of Atonement, when God would atone for the sins of national Israel. And atonement has that sense of cleansing or purifying. And purging kind of has that element to it as well. But what's happening here is God is purging the land of Canaan, which is the inheritance that we've been talking about that was promised in the Abrahamic covenant. God is purging that area out of all the wicked so that the righteous can inherit that land through the resurrection. Peter, in 2 Peter chapter 3, he talks about this renewed sky or renewed land or new heavens and new earth. And he says, we according to his promise, look for a new heavens and new earth in which righteousness dwells. Well, Peter is talking about this process. The reason why righteousness dwells is because the wicked are removed. You guys are pretty familiar with Psalm 37, right? That David prophesies over and over in that psalm about the destiny of the wicked and the destiny of the righteous, and how the destiny of the wicked is to be cut off, and the righteous is to inherit the land forever. You know, David says that for evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait on the Lord shall inherit the land. You know, and he even goes on and says, you know, indeed you will look carefully for him, but it shall not be found. But the meek shall inherit the earth and delight themselves in the abundance of peace. Now, who quoted from that psalm that said the meek shall inherit the land, or the meek shall inherit the earth? Jesus did in the Sermon on the Mount, quoting from Psalm 37 from David about how the wicked would be removed, and and David goes on to say how the descendants of the wicked would be cut off, but the righteous should inherit the land and dwell in it forever or permanently. So Jesus is referring in the Sermon on the Mount, when he says the meek shall inherit the land, back to David's psalm about the righteous inheriting the land through resurrection and the wicked being removed at the same time. And this is, remember back in Genesis 22, I mentioned about your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies, one of the promises that God gave Abraham at the latter end of that chapter. Well, the reason why, you know, the descendants, he's referring basically the saints, will possess the gate of their enemies is because the wicked are being removed and God's people are going to reign and rule. You know, that's why John in Revelation 20, he sees this image of, he says he sees, I saw thrones and those seated on them, and the authority to judge had been given to them. In other words, they've been given the authority to judge, rule, and reign. And, you know, he actually goes on to talk about how all those that were beheaded during the tribulation are raised to life in the first resurrection, and they reign with Christ 1,000 years. And this concept of the righteous dwelling and inheriting this land, as we just read Deuteronomy 32, God purging out the land for his people to dwell in, is also thoroughly connected with the Davidic covenant. And what we're going to do next week is we're going to look at the Davidic covenant. And we've been talking about this seed, this prophetic seed, you know, from Genesis chapter 3, and the seed in the Abrahamic covenant. Well, there's also a seed mentioned in the Davidic covenant. And what we're going to find is how this seed, through this seed, would come these promises of everlasting peace in the land of Canaan, and this concept of the righteous being raised to immortality and dwelling in the land without the threat of oppression and persecution, you know, as they are now. We'll look at the Davidic covenant next week, and some of the elements of that, and how resurrection is so important, particularly Jesus Christ's resurrection, to that covenant and God's promises coming to fulfillment. So, do you guys have any questions? All right.